this one, she's not like tried to bring it home. She's more like nosedived the plane into the runway in some sort of kamikaze style to kill the thing altogether. It's disastrous what she's done with it at the in the epilogue.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 38 of Vassals of Kingsgrave's Agatha Christie reread. My name is Bina 007, and I will be your host today as we go through Taken at the Flood, aka There Is a Tide, originally published in November 1948. And joining me to discuss what some would consider to be minor tier Agatha Christie is Pat.
Yes. Hi there. 2.0 in the Discord.
And I think it's fair to say that while we both have issues with this novel that we will get into, we decided to do a full podcast because there's a lot of really fascinating social change and post-war England description in here. So it's an interesting novel from a historical perspective, even if not from a detection perspective. So let's get into it. For a start, there's a long gap between this and the last novel that we covered in terms of publication date, because it was both preceded and followed by short story collections. And the title of the book in both the UK and US markets is a line from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar in a speech by Brutus that we had to learn at school. There is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. So this idea that there is if there's an opportunity, you can take it to great success or failure. Right.
Yeah, an important quote for all ruthless capitalists out there. So.
Absolutely. And I'll give a little plot summary before we get into, as usual, the historic context, what's going on with social change, post-war life, the characters, the adaptations. As always, listener, we will be spoiler-free until the post-credits, the end credits music, when we'll discuss the plot. So the plot summary is as follows. The novel is set shortly after World War II. A few weeks after marrying an attractive young widow, Gordon Clode is tragically killed by a bomb blast in the London Blitz. Overnight, the former Mrs. Underhay finds herself in sole possession of the Clode family fortune. Shortly afterwards, Hercule Poirot receives a visit from the dead man's sister-in-law, who claims she has been warned by spirits that Mr. Underhay's first husband is still alive. Poirot has his suspicions when he is asked to find a missing person, guided only by the spirit world. So basically, we have, as always in Agatha, not as always, but very, very often in Agatha Christie, we have a patriarch, a head of a family. He's incredibly wealthy. He dies. He's married a new wife, and the children, the adult children who were dependent on their inheritance, are suddenly cut out of the will. And this brings family strife. And apparently, I did some calculations. The fortune that's at stake would be worth £51 million today.
And I think this is an important question, Bina. Would that be worth going through the sort of like long-winded murder from Sad Cypress for? Because you didn't feel £17 million was enough for all the plotting. Would £51 million be enough?
It depends, I think, if you think it could set you up for life. And I suspect...
£51 million wouldn't be enough for you. It might get you to next year.
Right. So realistically, it's £25 million. Got to buy a townhouse, a country house. You've got to run them for life.
Mm.
I think I would commit multiple murder if it was in excess of 100.
Right, okay. Warning to all Vassals of Kingsgrave's members out there, if you fall into £100 million, don't let Bina know. So
she's read a lot of Agatha Christie and she's unscrupulous. Yeah, absolutely. How about you? Would £51 million be enough for you to murder people for?
It depends who it was. I'd probably do it for less for some people. So
brilliant. So just before we get into it, so was this your first time reading the book, and what was your sort of summary impression of it?
Yeah, so it's a good book. I would have put it mid-tier, but it's the epilogue. Like, if anybody's listening to this and interested in reading it, I would stop short of the epilogue. Once Poirot's revealed who the murderer is, drop the book, rip those pages out, and you'll be much more satisfied. I mean, it's got some great humour in it. You've just mentioned Poirot's run-in with the occult at the start, and his sarcastic and ironic appraisal when he's talking to Catherine Clode is hilarious. You know, so I think it's got some good points in it. I really enjoyed it until the end, and now I hate it, and I wish I'd I'd not read the last few pages.
Okay, so the novel takes place basically in a very shortly post-World War II England, and life is very topsy-turvy. The formerly rich and idle are now suffering the consequences of many years of war, where their fortunes have been diminished and where the social order is now being changed. For those of you who maybe aren't British and don't know our history, after World War II, there was a landslide victory for a Labour government, very much with the idea of building a new Jerusalem, a land fit for heroes of all classes that would have far greater redistribution of wealth, that would put into place things like the National Health Service and a lot of the pillars of our social infrastructure that today are decaying. But it was a very optimistic time for those people who wanted to see that. But obviously for the people who were at the top of the tree, a time of great uncertainty. And what I love about this novel is that really comes through. And we have lots and lots of examples of this coming through. So I'd written down some quotations in my notes, well, quite a lot actually. So the first one I had was suburban development. So the idea that before the war, a lot of Agatha Christie novels were set in these quaint, twee little villages. But now you have a housing crisis, right? You've had the Blitz, you've got population growth, you've got people who need housing that's fit for modern life. And a lot of these villages with railway line extensions out to the sort of the home counties around London have got new developments springing up. And Walmsley Heath is a classic example of this. So the setting of this novel, I'm going to quote now from the book. Walmsley Heath consists of a golf course, two hotels, some very expensive modern villas giving onto the golf course, a row of what were, before the war, luxury shops, and a railway station. Emerging from the railway station, a main road roars its way to London on your left. To your right, a small path across a field is signposted footpath to Walmsley Vale. Walmsley Vale, tucked away amongst wooded hills, is as unlike Walmsley Heath as well can be. It is, in essence, a microscopic, old-fashioned market town, now degenerated into a village. It has a main street of Georgian houses, several pubs, a few unfashionable shops, and a general air of being 150 instead of 28 miles from London. So yeah, I mean, this is a very different time, and the kind of that, I guess this is the rise of the suburbs. I should know more about this, right? The history of development, but it does feel quite different.
Yeah, I mean, this Walmsley Heath is, it will be inevitably swallowed by Greater London. You know, it'll have its own tube stop soon, or at least rail links to the underground. You know, it'll be a lot like somewhere like Potter's Bar or Watford. You know, it's basically just going to get swallowed as London grows.
Okay. And then the next thing I noticed was, apart from the suburban sprawl, was the cost of living and rationing. And this is going to come through really strongly, and I think kind of reach its peak in the book, A Murder is Announced, and kind of like the corrupting impact of rationing on life in villages, where you have the black market and bartering. And I think what a lot of people don't realize, and I certainly didn't actually until researching this, is that rationing in England was far worse after the war than during it. And it lasted for 10 years after the war ended. So cost of living and rationing, we think we're in a cost of living crisis now. But it's huge in this novel. And I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 examples that I've excerpted. I won't read them all, obviously. But it shows that frequency of mention, how far it must have been on Agatha Christie's mind as someone who loved her food and how to run a household too.
Yeah, and I think you'll probably find that she's not at the sharp edge of it. And the people in this book aren't at the sharp edge of it. You know, they're relatively protected. I know these rich people are having such a hard time, you know, getting by. Worrying about having their second gardener, you know, it is terrible for them. But I mean, there are also accounts of this period where people were far worse off.
Yeah, let's just give a few examples here. "Well," said David easily as he lit his own cigarette, "what's wrong at Walmsley Vale? Has our cook been dealing in the black market? She provides us with wonderful food, and I've always wondered if there was a sinister story behind it. When someone's getting married," here's the quote, "I suppose they'll be able to produce the coupons all right," in reference to the bridesmaids. "It's very lucky for you having all your D-mob ones. I'm really terribly sorry for girls who get married nowadays." So this idea that to buy a wedding dress, you have to put all your clothes rationing coupons and try and get enough for a wedding dress. And then lots of people worrying about taxation, which I suspect is very much an Agatha Christie issue. Quote, "Rosaline can't touch the capital, you know, only the income. And she pays about 19 and 6 in the pound income tax." So I actually had to look up. I was like, so how many shillings were in the pound?
24.
Yeah, so 19-6. That is an incredible marginal tax rate.
Yeah, you're looking at about 80%, roughly speaking. So
absolutely. So no wonder they're worried about taxation. Major Porter complains about taxation and increased of cost of living. And the fact that the last thing he's going to cancel is his club subscription. So it runs all the way through the novel. The other thing that runs through it is this idea of people who were demobbed and had probably quite interesting lives in the war and are now trying to settle back into normal existence.
Yeah, I like a quick aside on that, because I think this is probably, for me, one of the most important aspects of this book from the sort of socio-economic side. Because I think what Christie has documented here, maybe unknowingly, is actually the influx of women into the labour market. This is the starting point of it, because all these women who were part of the war effort have come out and they've realised that, you know, they've got skills and talents that can be used outside of the family home. And I don't think it's happening as much here, but I think this is like, it's part of the Rolling Stones starting to gather moss, you know, off the back of feminism. Off the back of the suffragette movement in sort of like the 20s and 30s, you've now got the, I think there's a bit in the book where they're talking about all these wrens, she's reading the paper, and all these wrens who are applying for positions, you know, and they've all held quite important positions inside the military, you know, and I think you see it starting here. And I think it's maybe one of the biggest sort of socio-economic impacts that Britain's undergone. I mean, arguably, economically-wise, it's probably the most important. It's been the influx of women into the labour market, because it's improved Britain's productivity. We've just got so many more people working in the economy.
Yeah,
you know, and Agatha's charted that here. This is the starting point of it.
But you've got to find people who will accept you on the terms that were available during the war, right? So in the war, you had a certain equality that maybe isn't afforded you in civilian life. So Lynn Marchmont, one of the characters that we'll get to, is exactly that. She's a demobbed wren and seeking work, very bored, going back into her country house life, dependent on a now dead relative. And she's looking in the newspaper, and this is the quote. "Oh, brave new world," thought Lynn grimly. Her eyes rested lightly on the columns of the daily paper. XWAAF seeks post where initiative and drive will be appreciated. Another one. Former wren seeks post where organizing ability and authority are needed. Enterprise, initiative, command, those were the commodities offered. But what was wanted? People who could cook. You know, I think it's really tragic, this mismatch. And it's kind of interesting. I was reading much further on in our reread. I was reading 450 from Paddington, just so I could give it to my godson, who's making a collection of these books. And even in the 50s, this restlessness of people who are demobbed and were so much better used in the war continues. So I think it was a real opportunity, as you say, for the economy, but also a problem for death. Another aspect of that social change is the way in which the class boundaries in British society, while still evident, are weakening or changing. So here are some examples of class, and we'll get into race, obviously, and racism against the Irish. But, "And then, dear," Mrs. Marchmont lowered her voice, "I hate to say it, but of course she's not a lady." "What an expression, mums. What does that matter nowadays?" "It still matters in the country, dear," said Adela placidly. "I simply mean that she isn't exactly one of us." So seeing that differentiation between the generations of those that still care about these very antiquated delineations and those that don't.
And I think that it's still there. I mean, we were talking about this, I think, in the last podcast, where I was talking about communities need to create outsiders and their ability to coalesce to try and protect themselves. And you see this constantly in the village. People are always saying, "Well, we think you were hard done to as a family because all the money didn't come straight to the family. And you're like the local gentry. You should have had it all," rather than these outsiders who've come in and got it all. So you see them coalescing. You know, there's that bit where the landlady of the Stag is eavesdropping to try and find out some gossip about the outsiders. And then she passes it straight on, you know, to the people who she thinks should be using it and are entitled to it, you know, not for any other reason than an accident of birth.
And that lack of trust, that lack of community where community once existed, I think is a big theme in this book, but also in the forthcoming books. It really, reading them closely together, I've realized how powerful a theme this is in the post-war novels. This is how Lynn describes it, which I think is really well written, and maybe Agatha. There were waves in the air of feeling, a strong electrical current of, what was it? Hate? Could it really be hate? Something at any rate destructive. Lynn thought suddenly, but that's what's the matter everywhere. I've noticed it ever since I got home. It's the aftermath war has left. Ill will, ill feeling, it's everywhere. On railways and buses and in shops and amongst workers and clerks and even agricultural labourers. And I suppose worse in mines and factories. Ill will, but here it's more than that. Here it's particular. Here it's meant. So this idea that this is a time of great social change and upheaval and modernisation, and that there's a lot of angst and division that comes with that. Again, I don't think Agatha's ever spoken quite so bluntly about the state of the country, right? I mean, this feels like a real state of the nation novel in some respects, or am I overplaying it?
No, well, I don't. I think other writers have probably done it better. You know, I'm sure some historical documentaries at the time, you know, some nonfiction written at the time is probably much more on point. But like, she's still commenting on it, and it is not something that she's done. And the thing that struck me when I was reading it was like, Death on the Nile was written 10 years before this book, or 12 years before this book. And that's such a short period of time comparatively. But look at the difference in the two worlds that Agatha is now writing about. And it's such a stark contrast, you know. It's incredible, really, just see the drop-off. And I do think, like, with some of the clothes, these people could have been in both books.
Yeah. And are probably feeling very viscerally the life that has been lost to them, right?
Definitely, yeah.
But everyone is. I mean, you get a lot of very moralistic, I mean, just to sort of comment, sort of, there's a whole passage in Exchange where an old lady's bemoaning the fact that during the war, all the local girls were, quote, man-mad. Look at the way they wear dresses, trousers. Some poor fools wear shorts. And this idea that, you know, they're wearing too much makeup and they're flirting with all the soldiers and no one's wearing a hat. There's a real sense of outrage on the part of the elderly at what the war has allowed and permitted, which is basically a lot more fraternization between classes, sexes, races.
I know,
everything's been upended. You can't get the genie back into the bottle.
Yeah, well, this is Mrs. Leadbitter, though, isn't it? And she's a character from any time. I mean, I see her now as being chair of the local Conservative Association. You know,
the Women's Institute
for Brexit, regularly reads the Daily Mail. You know, and you know, she's a character of that period, but still got a significant streak straight through British society. So one thing that occurred to me was the phone calls. So like the waiting for phone calls, you know, and I'll call you. I'm sure some of the kids who are listening to this just don't appreciate what it was like when you were dating to be hanging around the family phone waiting for the phone call to come through, because they've all got mobile phones now and they're texting
and
each other.
And then also trying to get privacy, because like you take the phone call wherever the phone is, which is probably the lounge or the hallway. Yeah. Your family's hanging about. There was no privacy on the phone.
Yeah, exactly. I just think, like, again, if we're talking about this as a historical document, a socioeconomic document, this is another aspect of it that Christie's captured. And, you know, it wouldn't have been the case 20 years before this book, and it's not the case now. It's a piece of history that's gone, you know.
Yeah, well spotted. So,
and the other one then is they talk about the famous HP when they're talking about it. And again, the kids nowadays, would the most famous HP would not be Hercule Poirot, but probably Harry Potter. So again,
I thought you were going to say HP Source. My goodness. That makes me old.
But I got the reference, Bina. So I'm of the same generation. I know what you're talking about.
Thank goodness.
Okay, that's it. So we can move on to the events of the time.
Okay, so as I said before, Events of the Time is going to be a little bit longer just because there was a big gap. So the last book was published in November 46. We're now in 1948. So November 1946, Aspen is opened for skiing for the first time with the world's longest chairlift. Very exciting. There was the Havana Conference, which was a big conference between mafia bosses, which you can see sort of referenced in The Godfather. Very exciting. December 46, the first issue of the weekly magazine Der Spiegel was published in Hanover, Germany. Still relevant today, as we know, the owner of Der Spiegel, Axel Springer, getting involved in the whole Ackman sacking of Claudine Gay controversy at Harvard this week. So still of relevance. And very, very tragically and sadly, for those of us in the VOC community, Elizabeth Short, an aspiring actress nicknamed the Black Dahlia, is found brutally murdered in a vacant lot in Los Angeles. The mysterious case is never solved. We at VOC did record a number of episodes on the Black Dahlia, which I'll link to in the show notes. A fascinating case, incredibly tragic, because it also speaks to a young girl who was adrift after the war, as many were in Los Angeles at the time, and, you know, a case that's close to my heart. Moving into 1947, so we're now getting into a period of decolonization and also revolution. The communists take power in the Polish People's Republic. February 1947, the Voice of America begins to transmit radio broadcasts into Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. This is really the period where we're fighting over the Iron Curtain in those states between Western Europe and Soviet Union. March 1947, the Cold War begins. The Truman Doctrine is proclaimed to help stem the spread of communism. April 1947, the Dead Sea Scrolls are discovered in the Qumran Caves. And Jackie Robinson becomes the first African-American player to play Major League Baseball since the 1880s. I didn't even know there was Major League Baseball in the 1880s, but there we go. In May 47, David Lean's film Great Expectations, based on the Charles Dickens novels, opens in the United States. I think it's still one of the finest films ever made, and we'd encourage you all to watch it. In June 47, another little Cold War classic, The Doomsday Clock is introduced. Those of you who are fans of The Watchmen know very well The Doomsday Clock. Also in June 47, George Marshall outlines the Marshall Plan for American Reconstruction and Relief Aid to Europe, probably the most successful economic policy ever put in place. This is me editorializing. And Marshall wasn't even an economist, so that tells you everything you need to know. And I suspect we'll need another Marshall Plan for Ukraine soon. And The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank is published. Very, very sad, but lovely that we had that. July 47, the first prototype AK-47 assault rifle is built. We have the Roswell UFO incident. I'm sure there's those amongst the VOC community who have theories and are interested in that. Queen Elizabeth II becomes, then Princess Elizabeth becomes engaged to Prince Philip, the Crown fans. And we have the creation of the CIA, the Department of Defense, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the National Security Council. So US President Harry S. Truman very much shoring up the institutional fabric that lasts to this day in response to the start of the Cold War. In August 47, we have the partition of India. India gains independence from Britain on August 14th. Very monumental moment in decolonization. The largest and most wealth creating of Britain's colonies is now independent. But obviously, with partition, millions of Hindus and Muslims will die in that exchange of people across the border between India and Pakistan. So a great tragedy at the moment of independence. In October 47, the House Un-American Activities Committee begins its investigations into communism in Hollywood. So this is the start of the McCarthy era. And we also have the first televised address by President Truman in October 47. November 47, we have the wedding of Princess Elizabeth and Philip Mountbatten. We also have, this was just so fascinating to read. November 47, the United Nations General Assembly votes for the United Nations partition plan for Palestine, which basically will create the state of Israel. So obviously, clearly very important today. And December 47, 400,000 Muslims and Hindus are slaughtered in partition. And the global casual fashion brand H&M is founded in Sweden. So let me pause there before I go into 48. Anything catch your eye or ear there, Pat, in all the craziness that occurred in 1947?
The Doomsday Clock, because we get a mention of that in the book as well. And I do think the horror of atomic weapons is starting to dawn. It entered the general public's consciousness. And I think that's probably, you know, it's arguable whether it was the reason why we've had such a prolonged period of peace in Europe over the last sort of like 50, 60 years. But I definitely think that idea of sort of like mutually self-assured destruction is one of the reasons why, you know, there has been this sort of standoff, this stalemate between nations in Europe. I think that's...
There's a reason why we're only arming Ukraine and not committing troops, right? Because we're so scared of starting a nuclear war with Russia. Yeah. So I think it kind of still holds in a way, but yeah. I guess we're contested. Okay, well, let's get into 1948 so we can quickly catch up to the novel. So January 48, we have the assassination of Mahatma Gandhi, shot by a Hindu fascist extremist called Godse in New Delhi. Very, very sad, obviously. Okay, 1948, to lighten the tone. NASCAR is founded in the US. I don't understand the attraction of cars just going round and round. I'm a
Formula One fan.
Yeah. March 1948, the Hells Angels are founded. April 1948, we get civil war in Palestine. We get the start of the Marshall Plan being signed into law. Land Rover is unveiled at the Amsterdam Motor Show. And we get the American Broadcasting Company founded, so ABC. May 48, the RAND Corporation is established, still exists today. Very influential, independent research, sort of military industrial research company or organization. May 48, we also get the Israeli Declaration of Independence. David Ben-Gurion becomes the first prime minister. We also get the election of Daniel Francois Malan in South Africa, which starts the era of apartheid. So just as India is getting independence, apartheid is being put in place in South Africa. June 48, Puma is founded in Bavaria, West Germany, after one brother splits from his other brother, Adi, who'd founded Adidas, which always like cracks me up. Columbia Records introduces its 33 and a third RPM long playing phonograph against the kids are not going to know. Or maybe vinyl's fashionable now. Maybe the kids do know. What am I talking about?
Yeah, it's made its comeback.
Yeah. And in June 48, all that time after the end of World War II, the Deutsche Mark becomes the official currency of Germany. So what were they using between the end of the war and then? Dollars? I don't know.
Probably dollars.
Marks, hugely devalued. It must have been an absolute shit show. We also have the Manchester Baby becomes the first stored program computer to successfully execute a program. The Empire Windrush brings more than 800 Afro-Caribbean immigrants to England. Recently, very controversial in terms of how their descendants have been treated, but a very big moment for colonial people coming into the mother country and not necessarily being greeted wonderfully. And we have the David Lee and Oliver Twist movie premiering. It's banned for 3 years in the US because of alleged anti-Semitism in the depiction of Fagin by Alec Guinness. I did not know that. And again, it speaks to something we found in the Agatha Christie, isn't it? That sort of horrific racism that's allowed by English publishers is immediately picked up on by the US. So maybe that speaks well to the US. And the Berlin blockade begins. So this fight over who's going to have control over the countries between West Europe, Western Europe and Soviet Union. The Berlin blockade has begun. And July 48, the start of the National Health Service. Yay. President Harry Truman issues the second peacetime military draft in the US. Apparently the first one was in 1940 because of those tensions with the Soviet Union. So I find that fascinating. They were literally calling up men in 48 thinking they were going to fight another hot war. I had no idea that happened.
I think the next hot war is not too far away, is it? I think they're going to be fighting in Korea soon. So
yeah, wise move. Truman also ended official racial segregation in the US Armed Forces, although not actual racism. The 48 Summer Olympics was in London. First Olympics since 1936 in Berlin. Oh, how times have changed. And the Idlewild Field in New York becomes New York International Airport, later to be renamed JFK. So it's the start of JFK. August 48, both North and South Korea are established. Margaret Chase Smith is elected United States Senator, becoming the first woman to serve in both the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate. And in November 48, it's an election year, much like this year, we have a U.S. presidential election. Harry Truman, the incumbent, defeats Thomas E. Dewey, the Dixiecrat Strom Thurmond, and Progressive Party candidate Henry A. Wallace. So Truman is reelected. And in November 12th, the War Crimes Tribunal in Tokyo sentences 7 Japanese military and government officials to death, including General Hideki Tojo, for their roles in World War II. So a lot of history. You're still getting the reverberations of World War II. You're getting the start of the Cold War that will have its hot war flashes in places like Korea. And you're getting, you know, independence of India, ructions in the Middle East, decolonization, how all that's going to affect people's
lives. Yeah, I think that's the big thing. It's one of the big things, decolonization and the way it's still affecting us today.
Yeah.
You know, these are all problem spots in the world, like apartheid in South Africa rumbled on as a massive problem. You still have India and Pakistan, or they've got a Cold War going on between themselves at this moment in time. North and South Korea are still divided. You know, we still have conflict flashpoints after, you know, 70 years.
So, yeah, I mean, like, you know, we're fighting a proxy war with Russia right now.
Yeah.
It's, these things don't go away, do they, unfortunately? Okay, well, let's pivot back to the book. And as we said, this is all about the Claude family, Gordon Claude, who has died in the Blitz. His widow, his very young widow, inheriting all the money, putting the family's nose out of joint. Let's get into the characters. So we start with Hercule Poirot. Have you got any Xander, Lord Baron, little Hercule Poirot bon mots?
I have got one. Yes. Poirot says right at the very start of the book, when he's about to meet Catherine Claude, if a middle-aged lady wearing sham Egyptian beads has made up her mind to see the famous Hercule Poirot, and she has come up from the country to do so, nothing will defeat her. So Poirot is referring to himself in the third person again, and has modestly just referred to himself as famous.
There you go. Wonderful. And then we have the widow, Rosaline Claude. Twice widowed, while in her early 20s, she was formerly Mrs. Robert Underhay. Her husband died in Africa. She lived with him in Africa as part of the colonial system. Most recently married to Gordon Claude, an actress, Claxon, I've written. My quote for her is, that wouldn't have been much fun for Rosaline, would it? She was 24 when she married him. She's only 26 now. She looks even younger, said Lynn. David looked across the table. Rosaline Claude was crumbling her bread. She looked like a nervous child. Yes, he said thoughtfully, she does. Complete absence of thought, I suppose. any feelings about Rosaline Claude?
No, not really. I think the only two characters who I really want to comment on are Lynn and David Hunter. I think the rest of them, you know, are they're there as plot delivery devices.
I completely agree. So let's get to David Hunter. So basically, Rosaline's inherited all the money, which actually might have turned out all right for the Claude family, because she's probably quite a soft touch. The problem is she's guarded very fiercely by her Irish brother, David Hunter. Apparently, he was a former daring World War II commando and a gambler in life. Probably the kind of ne'er-do-well that Agatha quite is attracted to, or was in her younger days. He has gained luxury through his sister's marriage and is very anxious to keep it. I mean, he really reminds me a little bit of Monty, Agatha Christie's big brother. And he's got a quite sadistic, sort of mischievous, malevolent attitude, doesn't he? There's a great exchange. Quote, that's just what I get a kick out of, said David. I like seeing their smug faces eaten up with envy and malice. Don't grudge me my fun, Rosaline, she said in a low, troubled voice. I wish you didn't feel like that. I don't like it. Have some spirit, girl. We've been pushed around enough, you and I. The clothes have lived soft. Lived on Big Brother Gordon. Little fleas on a big flea. I hate their kind. I always have. And he's not wrong, is he? I mean, he's a nasty piece of work, but he's not wrong to hold them in contempt, because they are just parasites, aren't they?
Yes, there is that contradictory aspect to his nature. And I think you were saying, like, this comes out about it being a reflection of Agatha's brother, Monty, and the other characters that we've had in previous books. And Lynn Marchmont describes him, doesn't she? She says he was a thin young man with dark hair and eyes. His face was unhappy and defiant and slightly insolent. Lynn saw at once why all the Claudes disliked him so much. She had met men of that stamp abroad, men who were reckless and slightly dangerous, men who you could not depend upon, men who make their own laws and who flouted the universe, men who were worth their weight in gold in a push, and who drove their CEOs to distraction out of the firing line. So, like, you've got this character who is, you know, vital in a war. You know, the army needs these people, because, you know, when you have no ammunition, and when you've only got a snowball in hell's chance of doing something, you need somebody to make the snowballs. And this is this type of character. But, like, in peacetime, you know, he's contrary, difficult, stubborn, you know, malicious, petty, all the things that, you know, don't make up for good society. Mm. But so you've got this contradictory aspect to his nature. He is an enigma, really.
Yeah, and a very attractive enigma, right? So he is the attractive sort of evil guy. But I mean, I found myself quite rooting for him, even though I knew he was up to no good, just because he's not wrong. This family are all just ghastly. Let's get into the family. Then there are so many clothes, and I can't really go by them one by one. We will focus on Lynn at the end of this, but I thought rather than go through all the clothes one by one, because we've had these Agatha Christie families, haven't we, before, of kids whose lives are sort of thwarted by a domineering, very rich patron. And we're going to get another one in Crooked House and another one in A Murder Is Announced and all sorts still to come. I thought I'd quote from the Gillian Gill book, which is phenomenal. It's out of print. You can find it secondhand. Google Gillian Gill on Agatha Christie. But this is what she has to say. In 1946, as there is a tie taken at the flood, for example, the clothed men appear to fill conventional male social roles, since they actually practice the professions for which John and Lawrence Cavendish had merely trained. Jeremy Clode is a partner in a prominent law firm, and Lionel is the local GP. Their nephew, Rowley, has bought and manages a small farm. Only their widowed sister, Adela Marchmont, seems a throwback to pre-war times in her joblessness and precarious dependence on a diminishing private income. Nonetheless, as the novel progresses, Agatha is at pains to show us that the financial independence of Lionel, Jeremy, and Rowley is illusory. Like Adela, they have relied on the periodic generosity of rich businessman brother Gordon Clode to keep their heads above water. When Gordon is killed in the Blitz without making a new will, his whole estate passes automatically to Rosaline. Jeremy, Lionel, Rowley, and Adela get none of the large inheritance they had confidently looked forward to, and it becomes apparent that the superficially active male Clodes have been as defined by their status as heirs apparent as had been the idle Cavendish brothers. That's in The Mysterious Affair of Styles. Lionel cannot bear the idea of continuing to practice medicine and is desperate to retire early to a life of independent research. Rowley's farm has no future without the large injection of capital promised by Uncle Gordon. Jeremy Clode, apparently the most successful of the quartet with his elegant house and aristocratic wife, turns out to be in the worst situation since he has embezzled a very large sum of money from his legal clients. Adela's dependence differs from her brother's only by being at once obvious and modest. Adela needs only a few hundred pounds to buy new tiles for the roof and fuel for her furnace, and even this need makes Adela's proud and independent daughter Lynn both angry and mortified. Moreover, Adela at least asks for the money she needs directly. Jeremy, on the other hand, forced to borrow thousands of pounds if he is to avoid bankruptcy in prison, allows his wife Frances to touch Rosaline for the money and to plan more dubious tactics when the touch fails. So, this next bit gets us to the plot of the book. When Rosaline Clode dies suddenly, all the members of the Clode family come under suspicion because, in the Christian scheme of things, murder, usually of one's nearest and dearest, is a more natural and logical option than a life of bourgeois industriousness.
Yes. Savage.
Yeah, so the plot of the book is basically as follows, right? The Clodes all want Rosaline's money. So at first they try to find her first husband and claim that she's a bigamist, that he didn't really die. And secondly, someone has a pop at her and she eventually dies, right? But they just want her money. They cannot tolerate a life of poverty or actually having to get off their ass and get a proper job. It's just kind of amazing. What would you like to say about the Clodes and Lynn in particular?
I don't have anything to say about the Clodes.
And that's damning, isn't it, in a book?
Yeah, that passage that you've quoted from Gillian Gill, I think it's more concise and perceptive than I could ever be, and it nails it. The only thing I would say about Lynn Marchmont, and this touches back to what I was saying at the start, I find her a fascinating character, and she was the one I was rooting for. Because I found her introspection and examination of herself the most interesting part of this book. And I liked the bit where she and Poirot are talking and she's saying, Poirot, I've changed. And he's saying, you haven't changed. People are always the same. What you've done is you've discovered yourself.
Isn't that great?
I don't know which one is true, but she's definitely gone through some sort of growth being away at the war, where she's acquired this independence. And like I said, I think that's almost the epitome of what was happening to a lot of women.
Yes.
You know, at that time. And like, it's the first time I've actually read it in print form, you know, in a work of fiction, you know. And it interested me because, you know, I've read, you know, economic books that have talked about the importance of women entering the labor market after the war and things like that, but I've never actually read it in a fictional account. And it was just interesting to go through her personal journey doing this and the way that it's been triggered by the introduction of David Hunter. You know, he's the guy who's presented this dilemma to her. And I found that like the most fascinating part of this book. I like to see her journey.
I agree. You know, so. I agree. That is all that needs to be said about the clothes, but it is important. Lynn is an important character. And we're going to see more of her, more of that kind of character in future books. These very bright women who did well in the war and have discovered something in themselves. We're going to see that in books in the next decade of Agatha. That probably nicely transitions us into whether the book has held up to the modern reader. Is it progressive or regressive? I've got a fair few quotes here, one entitled What the Ever Living Fuck, but let's start with the racism, the anti-foreigner racism, coming from Major Porter, though, so the old club boar of a different generation, and he sort of looks Poirot up and down and says, foreign, of course, that explained the shoes, really, thought Major Porter, what's the club coming to? Can't get away from foreigners even here, but I mean, that is coming from Major Porter.
Yeah. And I think the other one then is Mrs. Ledbetter, who we've already come across. You discussed her at the start. And I don't think, apart from stuff that we'll have to talk about in the spoilers, I don't think there's much that's regressive in here. And actually, I would give Agatha a pat on the back for her Mrs. Ledbetter character, because I think she openly mocks her.
Yeah,
the conversation she's having with Poirot.
That's the thing. All the people in this book who are closed-minded are being mocked. I mean, even Adela, when at some point she gets into a conversation about Africa, which is a mysterious country, Africa, a mysterious continent, Poirot corrected her. What part? And then she says, Central Africa, the home of voodoo of the zombie. And then Poirot just says, the zombie is in the West Indies. Agatha Christie just pierces their sort of ignorance here.
Yeah, and she does it with humor. It's quite a gentle humor. I quite like that. The conversation with Mrs. Ledbetter, it has got a lot more malice. Like you get the feeling that Catherine's a bit more ditzy, you know, than Mrs. Ledbetter, who is just nasty. She's
like horrible. You know, I didn't realize this actually happened. I mean, I know it happens in real life, but to see in print, when she first meets Poirot, she says to him, in my opinion, you should all go back, capital G, capital B. Yeah. Go back where, inquired Poirot, to where you came from, said the old lady firmly. She added as a kind of rider, sotto voce, foreigners, and snorted. That, said Poirot mildly, would be difficult. Nonsense, said the old lady. That's what we fought the war for, wasn't it? So that people could go back to their proper places and stay there. And, you know, Poirot's a refugee after a prior war. I mean,
lived in the country for over 25 years. I was always waiting for him to say, like, what do you mean go back to London? You know, you want me to catch the next train to my apartment?
I mean, I think we'll get to this in the spoiler part of the episode, but I did write in my progressive regressive notes, the entire final chapter is insane. So maybe we can get there when we get there. But you're right. This actually, there are going to be far more egregious examples of anti-Semitism and racism. So yeah, excellent. Agatha on the side of righteousness here. Adaptations. There is one adaptation. It was part of the David Suchet ITV Agatha Christie's Poirot series. It came out in 2006, starring Celia Imrie, the wonderful Celia Imrie as Cathy Claude, Jenny Agutter as Adela Marchmont, and Tim Pigott-Smith as Dr. Lionel Woodward. There are a fair few changes to the plot. It's set in the 1930s. A lot of the kind of plot motivation and indeed mechanics are changed in a way that totally undermines the idea of the opportunity you've taken at the flood. So it's all very odd. I actually really don't like this adaptation. I don't think it's much fun to watch even on its own terms. And I think if you're going to, you know, get into this book, you're better off just reading it than taking the shortcut of watching the TV adaptation. Have you seen this one? Is this one that you
want? I have. Yes, and I think I would agree with you and the All About Agatha podcast. I think they were saying that part of the conceit behind the Poirot TV series was that everything was set in the 30s.
Yeah.
So they had to transport this back. And in doing that, they've just destroyed the underlying message of the story, the sort of the theme that runs, the unifying theme of the title that runs through the book is destroyed. The book's biggest strength is the time period it's set in. So
absolutely, couldn't agree more. Okay, well, listener, we've got to the end of our spoiler-free part of the conversation. Would we recommend people read this if they haven't read it before, despite the epilogue?
I think they would need to be happy with a lot of other Christies. And I do think that I would recommend that they read it, but it would be well down the list. And I think they'll be disappointed with the epilogue. That's the only caution I would give. You know, definitely shouldn't be the first Christie you pick up.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. All right, folks, we hope you'll tune in next time, where we're going to cover Crooked House and have Hannah with us to discuss that novel, which I think is seen as one of the greats, at least, although Pat may disagree. And after that, we've got quite a run of Miss Marples actually coming in the post-war years, if any of you are Miss Marple fans. But otherwise, we really hope you've enjoyed listening so far, and we will speak to you after the end credits music with a solution and some thoughts on that awful epilogue. Thank you for listening. So there are three deaths in this novel. Poirot says one is accidental, one is a suicide, and one is murder. The true murder victim was Rosaline. The woman known as Rosaline was not David Hunter's sister. His sister was in fact killed in the Blitz bomb alongside her husband. It was in fact the Irish housemaid Eileen Corrigan who survived the bombing. And that's why everyone says she looks so young, because actually Eileen Corrigan is much younger. She's also Catholic, so one of the clues is that she was seen going to mass. But if the first wife can't have been Catholic, right? Because, you know, anyway. So Poirot sends to Ireland for a photo of Eileen, which explains the truth of what happened during the war. David persuaded her to be Rosaline, but she'd been losing her will to sort of go through with it and getting more and more nervous as the book had gone on and the plot had gone on. So David then came to the conclusion he would need to kill Rosaline so that he could inherit her money, then marry Lynn, whom he's now in love with. The deal with Rowley is that he had been setting someone up to impersonate the first husband, who had hit his head on effectively the surround of a fireplace. So that was an accidental death, but was used to frame David Hunter up. And then, of course, there's Major Porter, who was set up as the person who's going to find the first husband and is the suicide. Did I get all that right? Have I got all the plot in the right place there?
The stranger, Mr. Arden, who comes in out of nowhere, is actually the brother of Francis Claude, or the cousin of Francis Claude. And they are, she comes from an interesting family, because although they are local gentry and her father was a lord, they also have colourful habits in fixing horse races and living off free credit and never paying bills and scamming local tradesmen. This character who comes in, Mr. Arden, is actually there to try and extort money by pretending that Rosaline's first husband is still alive. And Rowley, in a fit of rage when he discovers this, punches him and accidentally kills him. And Rowley then decides that the best way of sorting this out is to get the major, who he is aware of, because his uncle has heard the story that the major told right at the very start of the book about Rosaline's first husband potentially still being alive. He gets the major to lie at the inquest so that the inheritance that Rosaline's got can be overturned and returned to the family. So, but like, the broad strokes are the same, you know, in that
it's a lot of plot. How did you feel about the whole, all of it? How did you feel about this volume of plot?
I thought this was really good. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed following it all through. I thought, as I was following Lynn and David's arcs, you know, all this colour that was around it was great. I thought the Rowley character, you know, being bovine, we had echoes, I think you've mentioned it, we had echoes of Gerda. Mm-hmm. From the previous book, you know, still waters running deep. So this is another theme. Like I said, in the All About Agatha podcast, they were quite severe on this book because they said that a lot of these characters they felt were retreads. You know, we'd seen them in previous books and I haven't read as many. So some of these characters and their dilemmas were new to me. And
I think that's a bit unfair as well, actually. I mean, I think, you know, I've read all of them. I think the characters are genuinely interesting. And to me, that's what helped me stay interested despite all the kind of convolutions of the plot. What I would say about the plot, though, is there are proper clues. It's not like The Hollow. So if you want to know what the clues are, we know real Rosaline is an actress. We know that Lynn says she looks younger than her 26 years. So that's the first tip off.
There's yeah, and there's that one right at the very start. I mean, you can't read too much into it, but they do mention that David and Rosaline's eyes are different colours. Like David's got dark eyes and Rosaline's got very bright blue eyes.
And also, no one saw Rosaline or David after the marriage. So are they who they say they are? It's already intimated David isn't really her brother. You know, people suspect he's her lover. So you're meant to already be on guard that they're not who they say they are. Like we both just said, bovine Rolly, like Gerda, is not as bovine as he looks. Rosaline makes the sign of the cross when she identifies the body, so she wouldn't have wanted a divorce and to remarry. Major Porter already knows Rolly doesn't smoke, doesn't offer him a cigarette. And then David's call from London, it was put through to her. It could have been from anywhere. Like that, I think, it is a clue, but it relies on knowing a little bit how telephone exchanges worked in the 1940s, which we might just know, but I think a modern reader probably wouldn't pick up on. And then the fact there was no suicide note for Major Porter. So I think there are ample clues, even if there's ample plot. So
it also and she does, she throws in a few misdirects as well. The way David has been to see Lynn to establish his own alibi. And like, you don't get that David is out when Rosaline dies.
Yeah.
You know, so there are little sleights of hand that Agatha's put in there that do help keep you interested because you're thinking, how does it happen? You know, and she has done that quite cleverly. I think it's been quite well constructed from that point of view.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I think this is a very well plotted book. I think I actually do like the characters because I really like the character of David. I really like the character of Lynn. I love all the social history. So I was really like, for me, this was top tier Christie up until the final chapter. So let's just get into it. Poirot lets Rolly off for attempted murder and perverting the course of justice. There is, by the way, no double indemnity on arrest. And Rolly Lynn goes back to Rolly? I mean, like, what the...
Yeah, well, the thing is, like, it's not even Lynn going back to Rolly. It's the statement that she makes to Rolly, you know. I wanted a little bit of danger in my life, and I've realized now that just after you've tried to kill me, you know, that you're the danger that I need, and you're like, this is just garbage, you know.
And I don't know who is more psychopathic, Rolly, for being someone who'd strangle a woman, or the woman who likes being strangled. I mean, that's beyond liking a little bit of light S&M, isn't it? I mean, it's just bonkers. It's absolutely nuts.
It's not the Lynn that we've been reading for the previous 90% of the book. This is a woman who's been beaten. And this comes back to the argument we were having over The Hollow. Mm. And you were saying that the book needs to stay true to its own internal logic, you know. And if for a reason it loses its internal logic for you as a reader, then it will destroy the book. And that's what was so disappointing. Like, I really don't have a problem with Poirot does this all the time. He decides he's above the law and, you know, so he lets Rolly off. I buy that. In fact, I quite enjoyed that bit of the scene where Poirot just magically appeared and saved the day. I thought, oh, brilliant, because I could see it going, you know, the wrong way. And yes, there's no double indemnity on the arrest, but like, I'm not even sure that inquests work the way that Agatha's put them in this. Like, I
know.
aware of inquests having to have a jury, and I looked it up and they said only if you're dealing with like cases of police corruption, you know, because the police aren't allowed to do the investigating, so you would bring a jury in. So like, I think Agatha's bent it, but okay, we're entering Agatha's universe and she's reconstructed the rules and it's slightly different. Okay, I can buy all that, but not the way she's destroyed the Lynn character. Like, and she does. She like she buries this brilliant character that she spent a whole book constructing, and she does it in the space of a few pages. Right at the very end, a young progressive woman. She's come out of World War II. You know, she's almost discovered like what she's capable of, and she wants to get out there in the world and become some, you know, become the best version of herself that she can possibly be. She's stretching out, she's discovering new things and new people and being challenged. And then Agatha like throws her back to late Victorian Britain. And you're like,
I know.
What happened here? You know, and it ruined the book for me. And like, I would put it mid tier. you know.
Yeah, I agree. It's a great book marred by a really dodgy turn at the end.
I think it's like, I think I would forgive Agatha for what she did here, because I do think, like, and you see it in a few of her books, I think she's let down by whoever she's got doing the editorial work for
her.
Somebody should have sat there and said, Agatha, sometimes there's a time when you don't need to spell out exactly how the rest of everybody's life is going to be mapped out. Cut the book off.
I know.
You
know,
just after Poirot's Let Rowley Go. You don't need to finish it. Because, like, there will be some romantics out there who would say, oh, it would be great if Lynn and Rowley would get together. And they can go away and create this ending in their own mind and their own imagination if they want. But, like, people like me who don't want that don't need to read that last bit.
She does, with her proper Poirot, Miss Marple, she does like to tie things up, doesn't she, and get people to the altar. It's really pathological at this point.
Sometimes it works, you know, and sometimes it's not so bad. Like in Sad Cypress, it was disappointing.
Mm.
But it's criminal, like what she's done to it. It's destroyed the book.
Yeah, so. I agree. Excellent. All right. Well, I think we've done a thorough debrief on a novel that probably didn't deserve quite that much depth by the end of it. But actually, I'll take that back, because I think it does. It's a really interesting, almost like a handbrake turn between the wartime novels that didn't want to mention the war and the post-war novels where actually the social change really comes to the fore.
Like I said, I think I would have quite happily sat down and talked about this book for a couple of hours more if that epilogue hadn't been so disappointing.
Exactly.
Because, like, I think it's got so many interesting things to talk about in it. But she's murdered her own book. So.
Oh, murder on the dance floor. Well, thanks for jumping onto the pod and discussing Taken at Five for me. Listeners, join us next time for Crooked House, which promises to be equally controversial. And in the meantime, we hope you enjoy whatever you're reading and watching when it comes to murder mysteries.
Yeah,
and join us on the Discord if you want to find out more.
If anybody else is listening to this, join us on the, and you want to defend this ending, join us on the Discord, because I would love to read how you can put up a defense of this.
Absolutely. So,
and thanks for listening to me rant, Bina. So.
Oh, well, no, the rant was entirely one shared by myself. YouTube comments work as well. Come on, guys. Come in, you Rowley defenders, Poirot defenders for letting him off. Let us know where we're going wrong here. All right. Well, have a lovely rest of the evening, Pat. And
you.
All right.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks very much, Bina. Bye.